Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we'd love to tell their stories. New Chocolates in Brooklyn offers delicious and classic combination truffles and caramels, sweet, salty, some even with beer. Using single-origin cocoa beans, production takes place right in their shop on Atlantic Avenue. Come have a taste in one of our six Manhattan locations.
Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring people back to what's great in food. Culinary traditions, cooking at home, knowing your farmer, or even growing your own food. I spotlight good food fighters and the culture of the food movement, from chefs to tastemakers to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking Southern biscuits and a slice of Dixie. If you're listening live to Hot Grease on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we have a live call-in number, folks. Our number here is 718-497-2128. If you know zilch about baking biscuits, turn up the volume. Joining us to chat, the round, buttery, fluffy treat is Miss Natalie Dupree and Cynthia Grabart. Welcome to Hot Grease, y'all.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. So,
hi. This is Natalie.
Hey, Natalie. Cynthia, welcome to Hot Grease. This question is for Natalie. A Southern biscuit. People may not realize, but the word biscuit is not just only dedicated to the South, but people all around the world call certain things a biscuit. But what is a Southern biscuit?
Well, a Southern biscuit is a little like a scone. It's a very round normally, round or square, very light, almost cakey, but not dry, moist, flaky. Biscuit. Not quite a roll.
So it's not, I mean, you know, British folks call biscuit, they call it it could be a cookie or...
Right, it's more like a cookie. A biscuit in England was a cookie. But a biscuit to us is, it's a holder, it's a container, it's something that you put ham in and sausage in and jelly on. It's something that can be split usually and have something delicious put inside, but it has its own flavor of and tenderness. A wonderful vehicle for just about anything that you could imagine.
So, Cynthia, speaking of something different, I have this debate with all my folks. I'm from the South, but I have this debate from folks here in New York City about flour. What type of flour should folks be using if they're going to make a great biscuit? I love White Lily. Some people are in the King Arthur. But what flours you suggest in the ones that you've mentioned in your book?
Well, it is true that to make a great Southern biscuit, you need to use a great Southern flour. And we use White Lily. There's also Martha White and Southern Biscuit. And those flours are made from soft winter wheat, and they have a lower gluten content. And gluten is the enemy of pie crusts and biscuits, but you must have gluten to make bread. On the opposite end of the spectrum from the southern flours are the King Arthur bread flours that are very high in gluten, and that's what helps. That's what you develop by kneading to get a big rise in your loaf of bread. So the southern flours are very important to get a really light biscuit. You can tell the gluten level of a flour by looking at the nutrition panel on the back of the package. And the lower the protein content, the lower the gluten level. And that's a good way to gauge, compare it to a national brand or a bread flour, and you'll begin to see the difference.
So you can actually look on the back. Is there anything specific for folks who can't get their hands on southern flour? Should they be looking for in the ingredients?
Protein.
You're looking at the protein content on the nutrition panel. So you want to pick the lowest number of the brands that are available to you in your market. You can make a biscuit with a national brand all-purpose flour. Some people mix just a little bit of cake flour with a national brand all-purpose flour, and that does help bring that protein, that gluten content down, and will help produce a lighter biscuit.
Miss Dupree, let's talk baking soda or a baking powder. Which biscuits call for which ingredient?
Well, it just depends on the kind of rise you want. Baking powder is baking powder includes baking soda, but self-rising flour does as well. And actually, whenever I'm given a choice, I like to use a self-rising flour because it includes everything that you need to make it rise. It's got the salt in it, and it's got the baking powder, and so you have a complete package there, and you can make a biscuit then with just self-rising flour and one other ingredient.
Uh-huh. So it totally, I mean, what I'm hearing both of you guys say is that, Natalie, that baking biscuits is really about having your stuff in order in terms of what kind of flour you're using. Are you going to use baking powder? Are you going to use baking soda? Folks really need to do some work in advance. You just don't get in the kitchen and say, do I have any flour, and start adding fats and liquids.
Right. Well, you want to have, if you have using baking powder or baking soda, you want to avoid products with aluminum because they can leave like an aftertaste in the back of your mouth, I would say. And so you want to make sure that they're fresh. You know, the test that you used to do in school in science class, sort of with the volcano, adding an acid to an alkali, that kind of thing. That's an important thing to know, is whether or not your ingredients are fresh. And for me, the easiest way to make sure of that is just to use the self-rising flour, because it's got everything there.
So, Cynthia, we've talked about the flour. We've talked about baking soda. Next, we have the fats and liquids. For a basic biscuit and someone who's just starting off, it's their first time making a biscuit, what do you suggest in terms of fat and liquid to begin with?
I think for your very first biscuit, we have a recipe called Rachel's Very Beginner Cream Biscuits, and it's a two-ingredient recipe. It's self-rising flour and heavy cream, and the cream has the fat, all the fat that the biscuit needs to rise, and it has the liquid to help the dough come together, and that really can... That simple recipe can make a great biscuit and build a lot of confidence in the baker. And that's what you want. Biscuit making can be so intimidating, but if you break it down to the basics, start with a simple recipe like that with just self-rising flour and whipping cream, you're going to get to know how the dough feels, how it looks, what a wet dough does, and how light of a biscuit, an airy a biscuit of wet dough makes, and helps you get over some of those fears, and that's a really good place to start. Now, the truth of the matter is that lard makes a fabulous biscuit. Butter makes one of the best tasting biscuits, I think. We use a combination of shortening and butter so that we get the best of both worlds, the flakiness and the tenderness and the taste. So there are a lot of choices to make for you to decide what your favorite biscuit is and how you want your biscuits to be. We want you to spend $10 on ingredients and get in the kitchen and just practice. That's the biggest thing, is just get in there and give yourself permission to practice.
You hear it, folks. Practice makes perfect. We're going to take a short break, but we're going to come back with Southern Biscuits with Natalie and Cynthia. Keep listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back in a sec.
Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Leave a toy for Johnny. Leave a doll for Mary. Leave something fruity for Donnie, and don't forget about Gary. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto.
Tell him James. Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check out our program schedule. We have over 25 shows on Heritage Radio Network. You can go straight to heritageradionetwork.com or go to iTunes and put in Hot Grease or Heritage Radio Network for our listings. Hands down, the book Southern Biscuits by Natalie Dupree and Cynthia Grabart includes all the recipes and secrets to win in the kitchen. Miss Dupree is a James Beard Award winner and author of several books, and Cynthia has written The One-Armed Cook and the Culinary Version of What to Expect When You're Expecting. Welcome back, folks. Miss Dupree, I have to ask you, you know, the richest cooking school in PBS. I grew up like watching you on TV, and to have you on this show, I'm like, it's Natalie Dupree. How many times do folks come up to you and say they've seen you on TV?
Well, Cynthia was my producer, first of all. She produced the television shows. So she was in this with me together. She is my cohort in all sorts of crimes. And we can hardly walk through an airport still today without people stopping me and knowing who I am. Certainly in the Atlanta airport, I'll get stopped by anyone from the policeman guarding the check-in to a passenger or a airline attendant. So that's pretty special. That's nice. But then they do ask you questions offhand at the drop of a hat, so that you have to really always be on your toes.
So let me be clear. So did your shows only air regionally? Were they?
No. My shows were national and international. They were picked up by all sorts of international stations, and they aired in Saudi and they aired in Puerto Rico and all sorts of places like that. So that it's the places that I go to that people recognize me.
Absolutely amazing. So, Cynthia, Ms. Dupree just mentioned you producing the show, and the question I want to ask you is about the importance of having food mentors. Is that important? Do people really need food mentors, or can you do this all along, whatever you're doing in the world of food?
Well, Natalie teaches one of the greatest concepts I've ever heard of, and it's called the pork chop theory. And that is that one pork chop in the pan, when it cooks, becomes dry, but if you cook two pork chops together in the pan, the fat from one feeds the other. And Natalie has taught us all that there's plenty of room for all of us here in the culinary world. And certainly those of us that are fortunate enough to get books published and to be teachers and out there in the food world, we've all had fabulous mentors. My relationship with Natalie goes back 25 years now, and she has taught me so much. And I now have the opportunity to teach others and to help them come along in the food world. And it's so important. We all need mentors, no matter what our field is. And in the food world, especially needing a mentor that is grounded in what real food is and good, solid technique that can be translated across cuisines, across regions, and basically so that you can feed yourself and feed others.
This next question is for both of you guys. I think it was about a month or so ago, there was an article in the New York Times talking about cookbooks being dead. Are they dead? Or is everyone going on the iPad or going online? Ms. Dupree, what do you think? Are cookbooks dead, the printed version?
Oh, I don't think so. I couldn't part with my cookbooks. And, you know, you just can't read online for hours the same way that you can a cookbook. Most people I know also read cookbooks like they're novels. They don't just read them for recipes, but they read them to kind of prime the pump and get themselves ready for making dinner and for cooking for their family, or they just read it because they love reading about the food. Food is so intertwined with stories of life that when you read a cookbook, you're also reading about lives and about customs and the way that people eat. You pick up certain cookbooks and they don't have many desserts because that cuisine wouldn't have them, or others that are all based on rice. And you have others that are based on an array of spices, but the basic ingredients are very few. So, you know, they tell you stories, and I just don't think you can get that online. I would still rather research from a cookbook with an author that I know and trust than just to go online and search something out and get some information that may not be true. Man, if I try a recipe from a cookbook and it doesn't work, then that cookbook is, you know, that person is in trouble.
But exactly.
But if I go online, I don't feel like I can blame the person. I have to blame myself. I didn't pay for that recipe. I didn't vet it in any way, and that person wasn't paid, so they can't bear the full responsibility of someone that made the effort to write it and to get an editor. So I think I don't think cookbooks are dead, and I don't think people will ever stop wanting to turn to them in the long run and to have them.
Speaking of rising from the dead, my last question to Cynthia is about the resurgence of retro cuisine, or what I call period food. There are so many people in you know, all throughout the country, and I know a few people here in Brooklyn who are really looking at retro food. And what I mean by that, going back to recipes or books or anything that they can find from the 1700s or the 1800s. How do you see that trend, Cynthia? Do you see that as a trend, or is that something that's going to be here to stay?
You know, food is like fashion in a certain sense, that there are fads and trends that come and go, and popular foods fall out of favor and then find a resurgence, you know, 10, 20, 50 years later. there is a movement where people are really examining foods from other time periods, and I think it comes from the culture that we have now, where people are eating out in restaurants so much, and they're not satisfying themselves with food that is nutritious and that they've had a hand in making. And I think people are really searching for that comfort. And I think that's behind some of this, where people are looking to other decades for food that they want to satisfy themselves with. And so it is a trend. I think some communities are into it more, and that also has to do with the people that are writing the food articles in their community and what they have access to. But there's a lot we can learn from other decades and other generations, and reading those old cookbooks is such a pleasure.
In fact, that's one of the things I'll have to give you. This is Natalie. Just a little push. Cynthia collects a lot of antiquarian cookbooks because her husband owns an antiquarian bookstore, and called the Old New York Bookstore. And we will often sit there and read some of the older cookbooks that she has, Martha Washington's cookbook and some of the other ones, and just be amazed at how much of what was then is still now, and it still comes back as being something that you would always want to eat. And I've been reading a little quarterly publication called Repast that has an article on historic rice that was done by someone from local plantation. At Magnolia Plantation.
Wow.
So it's really all fascinating, but it tells you about lives before you, and I love it too.
Cynthia, Miss Dupree, yes. Thank you so much for coming on Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Listeners, if you are really trying to learn how to cook or bake a biscuit, go pick up Southern Biscuit by Gibbs and Smith. Thanks, ladies.
And you better call me Natalie next time.
Will do. Listeners, keep listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Bye.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Carlos Salguero. This program is being sponsored by Whole Foods Market. Let me give a Southern girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant, located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. The location of two sustainable shipping containers, also known as Heritage Radio Network. Okay, folks, so if you've mastered Southern biscuits, you should move to pie. On the phone to talk Southern favorites in her latest cookbook, Vegan Pie in the Sky, co-authored with Isa Moskowitz, is Terry Romero. Terry, welcome to Hot
Grease.
Hey,
Nicole.
So I want to talk about, I call this question all about the dough. In your book, the beginning starts off with different recipes or your definitive guide on dough. And the three I want to focus on are the three that are probably going to be used if folks wanted to do some of your Southern recipes. The single pastry dough, the buttery double crust dough, and the puffy pie dough. What makes the three doughs different from the traditional doughs in making pie?
Well, I mean, the single pie crust and the double pie crust are more or less the same. You know, one being a double, you know, because you want to have a top crust and a bottom crust, you want to make a double batch. But a lot of times you don't need that much, especially if you are making something like a custard type pie. You want a smaller batch of dough. So, and all our recipes are vegan, so we don't use butter, but we do use vegan butter. And we use shortening, and sometimes we use olive oil. We use all kinds of things. So those two doughs that I talked about before will make a light, flaky dough that melts in your mouth, and it works a lot like your kind of traditional pie dough. And the puffy pie dough is something we developed for our three hand pie recipes, which are really fun little handheld pies. They're kind of like a fancy homemade Pop-Tart. And a puffy pie dough has a little bit of soy yogurt, and it actually kind of bakes up kind of like a puffiness to it. I know. I'm sounding...
So
you know,
is it like puff pastry?
If
is it like puff, same consistency as puff pastry?
Not quite. No. Not quite as as intense as that. But it has sort of a lightness and sort of almost like a cookiness to it. And that holds the kind of fillings in a hand pie really well.
Yeah, I think when people hear the word, it's unfortunate. I actually love a lot of vegan recipes because you can't taste the difference. One of my favorite restaurants here in New York City, I'm sure you've gone there before, Terry, is Angelica's Kitchen. I mean, their freaking desserts are, and the food, you can't even tell that it's made with alternative ingredients. So I think folks should embrace vegan pie in the sky just like they would embrace normal Southern biscuits. I want to move to some of your recipes that I deem I put the hot grease seal of approval. And the first two are the sweet potato cobbler and the sweet potato Brazilian nut crunch pie. What made you come up with the Brazilian nut piece in that sweet potato pie?
Well, we both love sweet potatoes very much, adore them, use them all the time in all kinds of vegan recipes. And, you know, we wanted to do a classic sweet potato pie, but I wanted to have something a little different, a little exciting. So that pie has a little bit of South America in it. It has coconut milk in it. It has a little bit of lime juice that works beautifully with sweet potatoes. And I wanted a crunchy top. Like sometimes you see those pies with those beautiful kind of glazed nut crunch tops. And this one uses Brazil nuts, which I think are an underused nut when it comes to dessert. I love Brazil nuts.
It's totally an underused nut. And my favorite pie of all times, the pecan pie. You've put a twist, the salted maple pecan pie. Tell us all about the ingredients inside of this pie.
Oh, it's really great. This pie uses a little maple syrup because I think maple syrup works magic with pecans. And we also, I know this is going to sound a little crazy, but it really works to create that kind of creaminess. This is that kind of, you know, there's so many different kinds of pecan pie. This one has that sort of kind of custardy inside when the pecans kind of float to the top.
Yeah.
This uses a touch of silken tofu. And if you serve this to anyone, they would never guess in a million years that it actually has tofu. Just a little bit blended up with traditional brown sugar and maple and lots of vanilla creates a beautiful caramelly, rich, creamy center. It's really good stuff.
And what I'm the last pie that I want to highlight in vegan pie in the sky that is definitely Southern is the basil peach pie. I'm so excited to make this because I'm receiving my first winter CSA share, and we always get a ton of frozen fruit. First of all, am I able to use frozen fruit in making this basil peach pie?
Absolutely, absolutely. We're big fans of frozen fruit because, you know, it's frozen fruit's so different than what it was like, you know, 20 years ago. Like, you can get really beautiful, high-quality stuff that's dry-packed. It's not packed in that yucky syrup. And that sounds really exciting that you're getting stuff from your CSA. You absolutely should. And peaches, I mean, peach pie in the wintertime, that sounds amazing.
I know. Yeah. The winter share, you can't beat it, frozen fruit. Terry... folks, if you're listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network and you're on Twitter, Terry can be found at Terry Hope on Twitter. Her latest book is Vegan Pie in the Sky. Terry, thank you for coming on Hot Grease today.
Thanks.
Have a great new year, Terry.
Okay, you too. Thanks, Nicole.
Mm-hmm. Have a good one. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us here on Hot Grease. Join me here every Monday at 3:30 Eastern Time live, or catch me via podcast on iTunes. Until next time, always take the road less traveled.